What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Ron Coleman. Ron is one of the leading organizers and trainers with the Hearing Voices movement in the UK. He spent 6 years in a psychiatric hospital diagnosed with schizophrenia and hearing voices and has since recovered and now helps other voice hearers learn to live with their experiences. So welcome to Madness Radio, Ron Coleman.
Morning.
It's great to have you here, Ron, and I want to congratulate you on your important work in Europe and around the world, changing our understanding of voice hearing and helping people to learn to live with their experiences.
Thanks for that, Will. It's something that I love doing.
Ron, you have a very powerful personal story and also a lot of experience working with other voice hearers. And I was very fortunate to have an opportunity to do a training recently with you and Paul Baker from the Hearing Voices Network in the UK. Why don't we get started by telling us, how was it that you ended up in a psychiatric hospital in the first place? And what has been your experience with hearing voices? And how were you able to recover from a diagnosis of schizophrenia?
I've been a voice hearer, I guess, for much longer now than I've been a non-voice hearer. I've been hearing voices for over 30 years now. And I guess they started when I was about 21, 22. But they really started when I was about 10 or 11, in a funny sort of way, because that was the start of my journey into madness. I was brought up in... A very Catholic, Scottish-Irish family, and wanted to be a priest, to be honest, and ended up being abused in the church by a Catholic priest. And I guess that abuse, because one of the voices I was to hear later was a Catholic priest, was really the start of that journey that we call madness. Later on in my life, I lost my first wife quite young and joined the British Army, spent time really just playing rugby and being a soldier. The Army found out I had a brain. I did a degree in business administration and accountancy, so I became an accountant in the Army. And well, it was when I left the Army that I had started hearing voices. And that was really associated with an accident on the rugby field that finished my rugby career. I guess rugby was my coping strategy. I used to put the face of the Catholic priest on the opposite number and then spend the game trying to really hurt them and not minding if I got hurt in the process. So that led me really to a place where I isolated myself. I didn't like people. I always thought that relationships were dangerous, that people either abused you or died on you. So I guess I became a very lonely, angry person through that period of my life. And when I could no longer vent my anger playing rugby, I guess that's when the voices started. And the very first voice I heard was a female voice that told me something I was doing at that moment I'd done wrong. And when I looked around, there was nobody there. So I went, I thought, this is strange. So I'll be honest, I went to the pub and got very drunk. Came out of that, but then I started hearing voices daily, and not just one, but two and three, four, up till I was hearing six, and they would say all sorts of terrible things and attack me on all sorts of fronts. The voice would tell me it was my fault, I led him into sin, I deserved to burn in hell, and that was the Catholic priest. I had a voice that told me to kill myself so we could become a family again, and that was the voice of Annabelle. And really...
Annabelle was your partner who had died previously?
Yeah, she was my first wife, and that was really distressing. And I lost my job. I ended up having to sell my house, moving into a bedsit. And my life just became, for 3 months, a massive cocktail of alcohol and illegal drugs, where I was just wasted. I was seeking this oblivion away from the voices. And then one day I dragged myself to the doctor, and the doctors, being doctors, told me I need to see a specialist. And I saw a specialist that day, and it was a psychiatrist. And I remember that interview. And at the end of the interview, he said to me, "In my opinion, you may have a serious mental illness and you need to come into hospital for treatment." Well, I didn't take too kindly to that, so I told them where to go. And it was 3 days later, I was dragged into hospital by the police under what we call a place of safety order. And another doctor told me exactly the same thing, and they started treating me. That was the start of my psychiatric career. And by this time, I was hearing voices all the time. They were screaming and shouting at me. I'd just become totally introverted and lived in this world of voices by then.
So after the sexual abuse experience with the priest, you had this coping mechanism of getting your anger out on the rugby field. But then when you didn't have that, that's when the voices really started to drag you down into madness and you ended up in the psychiatric hospital.
I remember that first hospital, because they told me that if I took the medication, I'd start feeling better in about 10 days. And it was 18 months later before I got out of that hospital, and I was still hearing voices. And of course, by then, I'd learned that the way you handle voices is you deny them when anybody asks you if you're hearing them. You say, "No, they've gone."
Yeah, because you're trying to get out of the hospital, so you don't want to tell them that you're hearing voices because they'll just make you stay longer.
And they would just up the meds. They started giving me ECT because I got really depressed.
That's electroshock therapy.
I got electric convulsive treatment because of the depression, which is unfortunately one of the side effects often of antipsychotics for some people.
Is becoming depressed can be a side effect of the medication they give you.
And it was just, I would get to a stage where I just wouldn't do anything. I just wouldn't move. I wouldn't speak. I became essentially a no-hoper, say in the UK.
Yeah, people are sometimes called chronic or backwards cases. And Ron, when they first decided to hospitalize you, were you violent or suicidal or anything, or was it just because of the hearing voices that they decided to lock you up?
There was more to it than I was just hearing voices. I think I wasn't looking after myself. I was clearly beginning to feel suicidal because I couldn't see a way forward. I couldn't see a future. I'd been successful, and now I was totally the bottom of the pile, as I saw it. So I didn't see any future for myself. I couldn't imagine spending my life with anyone. I had no relationships. In fact, at that time in my life, I guess I'd become a child of Thatcher. This cult of the individual had been what had seen me through, but it wasn't enough. You can't be isolated your whole life. You can't live in a bubble. And I guess that's what I tried to do as a coping strategy.
So you spent a year and a half in a hospital and just learned to tell them that you weren't hearing voices as a way of trying to get out.
I think that's, for me, well, it's one of the saddest things that happens in psych systems for voice hearers. One of the first things we often learn is how to lie, how not to tell the truth, how to deny our own experience. And I think that actually hurts and damages us as people. And it's a survival technique.
And what kinds of treatments did you get in the hospital? It sounds like the focus was really on medications, and were they just telling you that you're a schizophrenic and the voices are just a symptom of your broken brain, that you have a brain disease?
That's exactly it. I was told that I had a psychotic illness, probably schizophrenia in the first instance. Then I was told I had schizophrenia, and then it was changed later to chronic schizophrenia. Even when I recovered, my psychiatrist couldn't resist writing a letter to my general practitioner saying that he was changing my diagnosis to personality disorder. So, I mean, I guess if you recover, there's a good chance you've got a personality disorder nowadays. So.
Because the belief is really that no one recovers from schizophrenia. So you were seen as this hopeless case that you weren't going to get better. And now they say, oh, well, it must have been a misdiagnosis.
I think that was it. I think that nobody believed that I could recover. And so it was really difficult to go anywhere. You buy into it. Well, I guess that's what I'm saying. You end up buying into this idea that you're going to be ill for the rest of your life. And I bought into that at one point in my journey. I think it had been about 8 or 9 years in the system by then. And I just bought into that this was going to be my life. I'd probably die before I was 50, if not from some kind of heart attack or something like that, but by suicide. And I didn't have a life. So that whole period for me, I call now my stolen years.
So, Ron, you spent 18 months in that first hospital, and then you were able to get out. What happened then?
Once I got out, I was looked after by a community mental health team. And that meant that I had a CPN, I had to turn up for meetings, I had to attend a day centre, do all those things that really made me a very good schizophrenic.
So they trained you into a new career as a mental patient now?
Yeah, and it is a career. I think it can become almost a career where you, over in the UK, they give us things like disabled living allowance, which is quite a lot of money. It actually becomes part of your lifestyle to be ill.
Yes, that's very similar to what happened to me personally. It's a real dangerous trap that people can get into, becoming that identity of the sick person. So what happened then? Because you didn't really get help from the community mental health system either.
No, I spent over the 10 years that I was in the system, I spent about 6.5 in total as an inpatient. You know, about 2/3 of my time I was an inpatient, and about 1/3 of the time I was being looked after in the community, often in group homes and residential facilities, which were just mini hospitals, really.
What were some of the things that happened to you in that period of your life as you were living as a mental patient and being looked after by the mental health system there?
I would often be visited by a nurse or a professional at home who would make a judgment on that day that I probably wasn't feeling well enough. So they would organize for me to be taken back into hospital. In the hospital over the period I was in, I had 40 ECTs over my journey.
40 electroshock treatments?
Oh, yeah, altogether in that sort of 10 years. So I lost a lot of things in my life. I lost memories. I lost skills that I had when I was younger. I even got to the stage where I forgot I could play guitar. I know that sounds crazy, but that's okay. I mean, I just didn't remember I could play. And it was only later on when my family said to me, why do you not play guitar anymore? And I thought, I don't play guitar. And actually, I do. And it was quite amazing to relearn. And, you know, once I started relearning, I started remembering things, or my hands started remembering things. So there was all that kind of thing that went on that really, when you reflect, is quite disturbing about your life in as I call it, service land.
Service land. So you were there in the system. You weren't getting any better. What they were offering you wasn't really improving your life. You had really kind of been given up on. You were kind of warehoused as a mental patient.
Yeah, I mean, people say to me, do I get critical of the system? I would have loved the system to have worked for me, Will, because then I would have got better and I would have got on with my life. But it didn't. And I think sometimes the system denies that there are people that it doesn't work for. They almost think, well, one day we'll get it right with you. And for many of us, it comes too late.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and we're speaking with Ron Coleman. Ron is one of the leading organizers and trainers with the Hearing Voices movement in the UK. He spent 6 years in a psychiatric hospital diagnosed with schizophrenia and hearing voices, and has since gone on to recover and now helps other voice hearers learn to live with their voices. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Yes, and you're someone who's come out the other side, but I'm thinking about all the people who are in the system in the United States and the UK who are still stuck there and who aren't being offered treatments that are helpful and aren't being offered any alternatives, and essentially they're being abandoned in the system.
Yep, and that is one of the real sad facts of our system. And it was one of the reasons when I did recover that I decided to stay in mental health, because I thought, we can't go on like this. We have to change something that really fundamental in how we deliver services to people and what services we deliver to people. It's not just changing, if you like, the bureaucracy. It's about changing the whole practice.
Ron, you said that the trauma of being sexually abused by the Catholic priest and also the trauma of the death of your first wife are what triggered your crisis and your hearing voices. Do you think that being in the system itself was traumatic, that the mental health system's treatments were traumatizing?
I think parts of that system does that. Every time you're pinned down and given an injection against your will, it brings back totally what happens when you're abused. It is the same kind of process where something's been done to you that you don't want to be done, where you feel invaded, which I did in my abuse, and I did when I was forcibly treated. So yes, there's a clear sense for me, even the trauma of being taken into a psychiatric hospital, police coming to your house, taking out your house in front of all your neighbors, and then you expecting to go back to live in that house. It's almost dehumanizing.
How was it that you were able to make it out of that situation? How were you able to recover? Because you were in a really low, difficult, oppressed, lost, almost hopeless place. How did you get from there to where you are today?
This may sound surprising, but the starting point for me was one worker who believed in me and also believed in recovery. You know, before we were talking about recovery the way we talk about it now, there was this worker who believed that I could get my life back, even though everybody else around me said no. And her belief was really a starting point of that journey for me. It was her that took me to my very first hearing group, voices group, you know, which had just started at that time in Manchester. And I guess in that group, that's where I really learned. Anne Walton, one of the first people in the Hearing Voices Network, came up to me at that first meeting and said, "Do you hear voices?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "They're real." And that is an amazing statement to hear after years of being told, ignore them, they're not real, you don't really hear them. And suddenly you've got this person saying, it's okay, they're real. And then, of course, just a few months after that, I met Marius Rom, who's a Dutch psychiatrist that started the whole movement, and Sandra Escher, his partner. And they were saying to me the same thing. Your experience is a normal reaction to abnormal events. And that's mind-blowing when you're told that. Well, that is really mind-blowing. And the thing that came with that for me is this idea that if it's real, I don't need to wait on anybody else doing something about it. I now have to do something about it myself. And that was part of the process of being in the Hearing Voices group, in that self-help group, where we were able to discuss these things and be honest about our voices and work them through, which was just fascinating.
So that was the beginning of your recovery, finding the Hearing Voices movement.
Yeah, that really was. It took me, I guess, a year to really get to grips with what was going on in my world of voices. And in just over a year after I joined the network, I became the first national coordinator of the Hearing Voices Network. So I guess in the scheme of things, no, it didn't take long. It was hard work, don't get me wrong. It was really hard work. I found I had to spend a lot of time on self-reflection, a lot of time negotiating with my voices, a lot of time creating structured time with the voices so I didn't spend all my time in that world and spend more time in this place we call the real world, which sometimes seems a bit surreal to me, as I must confess. But I did feel very much that the process took about a year. And then I continually had to work on myself since, because I believe recovery is a lifelong journey. I don't think it's just something that's an event. I think it's a process.
And Ron, this approach that helped you to listen to the voices, people telling you, yes, the voices are real, talking back to the voices, negotiating with the voices, this is very different than the mainstream traditional psychiatric treatments. And what about someone who would say, ah, look, this is a disease, this is a broken brain, you can't treat the voices as if they're real, that's just going to make you more delusional, that's going to promote people going deeper into their delusional reality, and we can't do that.
The problem is there's no any evidence for what you just said. Well, in fact, the evidence is the opposite now, that when people acknowledge the reality of their experience, when they work with their voices, when they get the opportunity to discuss what's going on with their voices, when they get to profile their voices, when they get to look at their life story in relationship to their voices, then they recover. I mean, but the most recent piece of literature, Marius Rom's book on 50 Stories of Recovery by Rom and Escher and Dylan and others, shows quite clearly 50 stories of recovery from voice hearers who all had to work through their voices. And yet in nearly every one of them, the first turning point was a professional who believed. This is not about knocking professionals. This is an emancipation movement for professionals as much as it is an emancipation movement for voice hearers. I think it gives us finally the freedom to practice, not from fear anymore, but to practice from freedom as practitioners. And it gives the voice hearer the freedom to work through their experience and come out the other side, which we don't have at the moment when our only approach is to use medication. And even worse, Will, when our only approach is to use medication and it's not working for the person. I think in any other branch of medicine, if something doesn't work, we do something different. You know, we don't try more of the same. We try something different.
You said that one of the things that was helpful to you when you went to the Hearing Voices group was to learn that hearing voices is normal. And that might really be surprising to people to learn that hearing voices is normally. Can you say more about that?
If someone goes through an experience like a trauma, like abuse, which is one of the main experiences that people don't talk about, and we hide that experience and we don't disclose it, somehow it's got to come out. And I think it sounds pretty obvious to me that if you suppress it enough and you can't deal with it in an internal dialogue or a one-to-one dialogue with someone else, then it will come out as a voice, you know. And when it comes out as a voice, the reality is that is a real voice bringing up an experience that you've gone through. And the reason it's real is because as a person, I hear it. That's what makes it real. It's not real to other people because they don't hear it. But the reality to me is I hear voices, and that makes them real to me. And I think to try to deny a person's reality would be like trying to deny a person's faith. We just shouldn't do it. We've got to accept their reality. Throughout history, we've had many voice hearers. I mean, if you actually look at the voice hearer, Socrates was a voice hearer. Bruno the philosopher was a voice hearer. Beethoven was a voice hearer, Mozart was a voice hearer, Leonardo da Vinci was a voice hearer. Just think about that group. What would happen if throughout history, we had taken voice hearers and locked them up and separated them totally from community. There'd be no Sistine Chapel painted. There would be no Last Supper as a painting. There'd be no Beethoven's Sixth Pastoral Symphony wouldn't exist. We would miss out on all these things because of our response. But historically, voice hearers have not always been locked up. The Bible was written cover to cover by people who heard the voice of God. Nowadays, if you say you hear the voice of God, people call it spiritual disorder. There is a real problem, I think, there with encroaching into areas of our lives that belong to us as human beings. All the people historically who heard voices, and that there are many musicians, politicians, artists, philosophers, have had a great impact on our society, and we should encourage people that hear voices, to explore their voices in a positive way, because historically, when people have been given the freedom, they've done amazing things. The Iliad, cover to cover, is about voice hearers. Everybody hears gods telling them to do things in the Iliad. In fact, there's no concept of conscience in the Iliad. One god tells you to do something, another god tells you not to. What's great about that illustration of the two gods opposing each other is the responsibility still lies with you, because you have to make the decision which one to agree with. So it's not about you blame the voices, the responsibility is still yours.
I'm looking at a list of famous voice hearers from history that comes from your training: Joan of Arc, William Blake, Van Gogh, Socrates, George Fox, the founder of the Quaker religious order, Jim Morrison, the musician, Winston Churchill, Gandhi, Saint Teresa of Avila, Da Vinci, Beethoven, even George Bush, the former president of the United States, said he heard the voice of God. And you said that this is an emancipation movement. Do you think that there's a parallel between the way that voice hearing is labeled as a disease by psychiatry and the way that homosexuality was labeled as a disease?
I think there is. I think we need to learn the lessons from the great emancipation movements, like the women's movement, the Black Civil Rights movement, and the gay movement, which were all about being proud of who they are. For me, being proud of the fact I'm a voice hearer is really important. I am not ashamed of who I am. I'm not ashamed that I'm a voice hearer. I guess in some ways I did take it a stage further in my own life. I had a tattoo put on my arm that says psychotic and proud, because I never want to forget where I come from.
Ron, give us contact information, how people can get in touch with you, find out more information, and get in touch with the Hearing Voices Movement internationally.
Our website's workingtorecovery.co.uk, and they can contact me on ron@workingtorecovery.co.uk.
Ron Coleman, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thanks very much, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Ron Coleman. Ron is a leading trainer and organizer with the Hearing Voices Movement in the UK. Ron spent 6 years in psychiatric hospitals diagnosed with schizophrenia and hearing voices. He has since recovered from his experience and now helps other voice hearers learn to live with their voices. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in.